Hello, Dominic Arkwright here, back with Health Today. In these programmes, we're bringing you news, views and music to help you make the right choices about your health and your treatment, basically to help you get well and stay well. Today, the threat the sun can pose to our skin.
I have sun lotion on at a high factor, I cover up, and I stay out of the sun in the midday. Certainly don't burn, and I wouldn't let my kids.
We hear from Imogen about a type of skin cancer, melanoma, and have some tips on what you can do to protect your skin in the sun. Also, one of the common problems that can affect our eyes as we get older, macular degeneration.
If you were to look at straight lines like a door frame or a window frame, you'd find that instead of it being straight and vertical, there'd be corrugations like corrugated iron. It would be wavy or curvy or distorted. And writing on the page can become not straight lines, but can become more distorted and curvy.
And looking after your teeth in later life.
Over half of 85-year-olds and older retain some natural teeth. So they have their teeth in their mouths for longer, and therefore they're at risk of developing decay and gum disease for that much longer.
Some advice to help you keep your gnashes for longer. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Right, in one of our earlier programmes, we talked about how to check your skin for moles, which may become cancerous. Consultant dermatologist Dr. William Porter gave us a simple guide to what we should be looking out for.
Well, in terms of moles, the concern is the cancerous mole or melanoma. And that can present in a number of ways, but we always ask them to stick to the A, B, C, D, E rule, whereby you're checking for A, asymmetry, B, changes in the border, so irregularity in the border, C, colour changes, so blues, blacks, reds within a brown mole would be of concern, D, diameter, so it's something that's enlarging in diameter beyond 3 or 4 millimetres might be cause for concern. E is really everything else, so itching and bleeding, which are fairly low risk factors actually. So an itchy mole wouldn't really worry me. But if you can't remember all of that, then the best rule of thumb is the ugly duckling. So the mole that looks different to all your other moles and stands out. That would be a reason to get an opinion from a GP or dermatologist.
Today we're going to hear from Imogen, who's had melanoma, a type of skin cancer, which she's certain was caused by too much sun, and we'll have some guidance on how to stay safe in the sun in a moment. But Imogen knew about the ABCDE rule, and she knew that something was wrong, but she feels her treatment came too late. She spoke to Rosie Runciman about her diagnosis, her treatment, and what she does now to keep it at bay.
I was aware of a mole on my back that had changed dramatically. It had grown, it had texture to it, had lots of different colours. It was over a centimetre in size. And I went and got referred to a dermatology department at the local hospital, said that I was concerned about it. They tested it under the dermatoscope glass test and said it was absolutely fine. This process was repeated 3 further times. On all occasions, they said it was fine and nothing for me to worry about because it didn't, even though it ticked the ABCDE irregularities tests, they weren't concerned about it because under the dermatoscope, the cells weren't moving the way that they were worried about. So they left it there. It was starting to catch on my bra strap. It was sticking out about 1.5 centimetres from the skin. It was crusty on the surface. It was a very different mole to my other moles, and I've got lots and lots of them. And in the end, I sort of said, enough's enough, I really want this taken off. The GPs decided that the best thing to do would be to shave it off and send it for testing because they thought that I might not want a big scar. So they shaved it off, but unfortunately, because of the size of it, it meant that the shaving off wasn't complete. So bits of the melanoma and the mole were left on the surface of the skin continuing to grow. Then there was a local hospital computer failure, which meant that the results were a bit delayed. So a month later, on the Friday, I came back from work to a letter saying, you've got an appointment Tuesday next week at the local hospital urgently to rule out cancer. And the next day I had another letter saying, under absolutely no circumstances, miss it. And another letter from the local GPs going, we want to talk to you, we've been trying to reach you. I went in on the Tuesday the 11th of June 2013. I was informed by a Macmillan nurse that I had melanoma, that it was not very good, but they didn't know exactly how bad it was because they hadn't got all of the mole and all of the melanoma. I didn't even know what melanoma was. came home, my husband sat on the internet and started Googling, searching straight away, what's melanoma, what's involved. I still hadn't really sort of taken in what I'd just been told, so I was actually about to go back to work for the afternoon when the hospital called and said, we've moved things around, the dermatologist wants you to come back this afternoon and he wants to perform the wide local excision today. So I went back in and they said that they had to do 2.5 to 3 centimetre margin all around the mole, and then they sort of, it's almost a bit like a leaf shape. So they performed this leaf shape and it looked like a big rump steak. And they said, did I want to see it? And I said, yes, I did, because there's that sort of psychological thing where you kind of want it to look bad on the inside. And then when you look at the inside, if it's not bad, if it's not black, you think, oh, well, that's okay, I'm fine. It didn't look bad, it didn't look black, it just looked like a lump of flesh. And they cauterized the wound because obviously it was enormous. It left a seven inch scar at that point. So it was quite a large excision, and then they cauterized it by burning the vessel so that the vessel stopped bleeding, and then pull the two sides together and then put the stitches in. And then I came home just shocked and numb and not really sure what that meant and how that changed my life at that point. Went through that sort of shell shock bit for a long time. Had a CT scan. I think everybody was expecting the CT scan to say, it's moved, it's progressed. It hadn't done. So there was this sort of massive sigh of relief from everyone. And I said, well, when am I going to see the oncologist? And the hospital said, oh, you're not going to see the oncologist because it's not spread. And I said, no, I need to see an oncologist.
So why did nothing show up on the initial tests?
I don't know. I don't understand why they didn't just remove it the first time I'd asked for it to be removed. It ticked every single one of the A, B, C, D, E's, the asymmetry, the border, the colour. It was wrong. There was nothing right about it as a mole, and I, as a patient, wanted it taken off. But because when they press the dermatoscope with the gel and the glass, the cell's colour wriggles around. Because they weren't wriggling and they were fine, they were like, well, that's okay, everything's fine, there's nothing to, this not cancer, it's just an ugly mole, so just leave it there. Should have been removed, and it was a mistake for it not to have been removed, and it's potentially going to cost me my life.
So what happened then? You went to see an oncologist, presumably.
I went to see the oncologist. I'd by now done my research and said, can I have blood tests? They said those aren't done by the NHS anymore. I asked about interferon, which was a drug that I'd found out about, and was told that was no longer available on the NHS. And that the Cancer Drugs Fund had pulled any funding for it. I was basically told there are no treatments, no drugs available for you at all. You now have to go home and wait for it to come back somewhere else in your body. And only at that point will you have any opportunity to fight it through drugs.
So in terms of treatment, have you had anything since?
No, I haven't. Nothing for melanoma. There's nothing available for me until it progresses.
How do you feel about the whole process? It's obviously very difficult to fight it if there isn't there's nothing to fight it with, in a sense, and it's a waiting game. Is that very difficult?
There's a massive watch and wait thing with melanoma up until the point that your disease progresses in one way or another. You're very much responsible for your own body and for looking after yourself. So I spent a lot of time on the internet and researched things and looked at what I could do myself in order to improve my own cells to fight cancer. So I took up drinking green tea, we eat organic, we grow all of our own vegetables now so that there's no chemicals on them. Yes, I looked online at the, not superfoods as such, because that's the wrong term really, but the foods, the fruit and vegetables that have been proven to have a benefit in terms of their antioxidants towards fighting skin cancer in particular, things like tomatoes and dark leaf, green leafy vegetables and carrots. So we grow all of those ourselves and eat them in abundance.
So how do you feel? I mean, do you sleep okay? Is it something which worries you at the front of your mind, or is it at the back of your mind, or do you forget about it for long periods?
It's in my mind and on my mind on a daily basis. I think there were elements of my care, especially in the early stages, that perhaps weren't what they should have been. And it concerns me that whilst I have a voice to be able to speak out, that I should be able to help other people who can't make sure that they have a better access to centres of excellence and that they're aware of what melanoma is, how dangerous it can be, how quickly it can spread around your body, the fact that it will come back inside and that there are no treatments and no cures for it, and the things that you can do yourself during that watch and wait time to improve your own chances of survival and longevity.
How do you feel about the sun now? You said you were brought up in East Africa.
Yeah.
So you were obviously exposed to the sun a huge amount when you were little.
Yes. I'm quite wary of the sun now. I don't want to be silly about it, but it's picking the right time and it's picking what sort of sun. I'll go out with, you know, on perhaps the school run in the morning. I'll take the kids to school in the morning when their sun's not hard, the sun's not high, and I won't have any suntan lotion on for that 5 minute walk down the road to the school. But for the most of the rest of the day, I have sun lotion on at a high factor. I cover up and I stay out of the sun in the midday. Certainly don't burn and I wouldn't let my kids. I long for the sun. I long for the warm and sunny days when you're not wrapped up in coats. And then I get a warm and sunny day and I have sleepless nights and I think, oh goodness, it's a warm and sunny day. We've recently been on holiday to Florida for my brother-in-law's wedding. And I didn't sleep probably for about 2 weeks beforehand because I was so anxious about the sun and potentially the implications, not just for myself, but for my children, for their skin, and thinking, you know, are we going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to protect their skin when we're there? And it does take time to adjust once you've been diagnosed with melanoma to the changes in your life and how melanoma is going to affect you forever, really.
So how do you feel now when you see people baking out in the sun?
I wish they wouldn't.
That was Imogen, and it does underline something we've said a few times in these programmes, that if you're worried about something, don't be afraid to seek a second opinion. Well, to find out more about what melanoma is and how we should look after ourselves in the sun, I spoke to Emma Wedgworth, a consultant dermatologist working in London.
I think the thing to be very aware of is that the sun can present different dangers to different people. So if you have very fair skin, then absolutely the sun can be dangerous for you. And equally, if you have less fair skin, so if you have darker skin, but you're exposing yourself to the sun very frequently, it can also be dangerous. As a dermatologist, we divide people's skin into six different types. So skin type one is people who are very fair, freckly, who burn very easily. Skin type six is somebody who has black skin. People who have skin type 1 really should be avoiding the sun because actually their skin is not made to be in the sun. They don't have good natural protection and they have high rates of things like skin cancers that can affect the sun. People who have skin type 6, on the other hand, are actually much more tolerant of the sun and they can spend a bit more time in the sun without getting so burnt. So yes, everyone should be careful of the sun, but you really have to think about your own individual risk.
What is the actual damage that these rays are doing to the skin?
So the sunlight produces a number of different types of rays. The main ones that we think about in sunlight are UVA and UVB. UVA is aging, so it can actually break down the collagen and other parts of the skin, which is what results in wrinkling and aging of the skin. And it may also predispose us to skin cancers. UVB is what's responsible for the burning that we see within our skin. So when we start to see that our skin's becoming pink, what's actually happening is the UVB is interacting with the DNA in our cells and actually causing DNA damage. And then that DNA damages, there's an attempt by our skin to repair it, and that's what causes all the redness and inflammation. So what's actually happening is these rays are penetrating our skin and actually causing some DNA damage. But remember, things are cumulative. So don't think, my goodness, I've got sunburned once, that's it, I'm done, that I'm going to be getting skin cancer. It's a cumulative effect. Having a sunburn once should be very much of a warning signal. So you should be then thinking, I'm not sun protecting myself enough, and I actually need to change my practice within the sun. So it's a warning to us that that damage has occurred. The skin and the body is amazing at repairing itself, but it can't keep doing that. And actually, if you end up getting burnt a lot, then that's going to significantly increase your risk of skin cancer.
What does sun cream do?
So sun creams can work in two different ways. There are chemical sunscreens and there are physical sunscreens. Chemical sunscreens actually don't stop the light from being absorbed into our skin, but they stop the reaction that happens between our cells' DNA and the sun. So they actually just block the sunlight from causing damage to our cells. Physical sunscreens, things like zinc oxide and titanium oxide, result in the skin not actually absorbing the sunlight and help to reflect the sunlight off our skin. And they actually prevent the sunlight from penetrating into our cells. So it really, in either of those ways, either the chemical or the physical sunscreen, it can actually prevent the damage that the UV rays can actually do to our skin.
What about sun beds?
Sun beds are really very damaging to our skin. There have been a number of different studies which now show that if you do go on sunbeds, you have a much higher risk of all types of skin cancers. And that's because partly they have a much stronger level of the UVA and UVB rays. So you're getting almost sort of 20 times the natural sunlight in those sorts of areas. So it's very concentrated and it can lead to increased risk of burning, but really it can significantly increase your skin cancer rate. So I would absolutely advise against using any type of indoor tanning. Sunbeds, absolute no-no, and really shouldn't be used by anybody.
Let's talk specifically about skin cancer. What should we be looking out for?
So there are three main types of skin cancers that we tend to see. The most common type of skin cancer that we see is something called a basal cell carcinoma. Then we see squamous cell carcinomas. And then the one that really can be very serious, although all of them can be serious, is melanoma. What we should be looking out for is any non-healing area, any new moles, any significant change in the skin that we're concerned about. Even sometimes some red flaky patches that just won't heal can be a very superficial type of skin cancer. So really it's just being aware of your skin, knowing your skin, and knowing if anything new pops up that doesn't actually heal within a few weeks. Those all should be alarm signals and should seek you to actually go and seek some medical attention. So I think if you're at high risk, if you have sun damage, if you've had something in the past, or if you have any other risk factors that we can talk about later, then absolutely you should get a partner or a friend or somebody just to check your back or the places that you can't see every few months. And now we're so lucky in that we've got smartphones and ways of taking digital photographs that actually they can really help us, because you can see what things are like at a certain point and then you can review that every few months. Now, I certainly don't want anyone to get obsessed with checking their skin all the time, but checking it every few months with a digital photograph can be very effective.
And you mentioned other risk factors?
So other people who are at risk are those who have a family history of skin cancers and those who've been brought up in, for example, very sunny climates in the tropics, people who have very fair skin, people who are on certain types of medication. So if you've had a renal transplant, a kidney transplant, or if you're on any other medication to dampen down your immune system, you may be at higher risk. So all of those can be risk factors for skin cancer. So I think there are a few rules of thumb. So with children, particularly with very young children, their skin is very sensitive. And we also know that what happens in the very early years really can predict what's going to happen to you later on in life. So those children who get recurrent burning, who have an awful lot of over sun exposure, certainly can be at risk of skin cancers later on. So particularly in very fair children, you should be very careful. We should be using garments that actually cover children up, hats, high SPF 50 protection. Make sure that children are not in direct sunlight between the hours of 11 and 3. But equally, if your child has naturally darker skin, then making sure that they're not sort of sun seeking, but actually they can enjoy activities carefully. Because there is a certain amount of sun that we would like to get, for example, for making vitamin D.
What about older people? Do they have to be more careful?
As we age, our skin changes significantly. So actually our skin can become thinner, it can become more sensitive. And many old people may find that actually their skin is more sensitive as they get older. They may also be on a number of tablets which can make their skin more sensitive to the sun. Again, I think it's about being sensible, it's about personalising things. We also must be aware that elderly people do need vitamin D to make sure that their risk of things like fractures are lower. So they may well benefit from some sun exposure, but again, being sensible, avoiding those very strong hours, listening to your skin type, making sure that you're careful about things. We know that elderly people are much more likely to be on a number of different medications. So it's just important to be aware of what you are on and how you individually react to the sun.
And when you do see something, you've done the search, you've taken the picture of your back, you found something a bit uncomfortable with, what do you do?
Seek medical attention, absolutely. I think skin is a fantastic specialty because in the vast majority of cases, if you pick things up early, we can deal with it, cut it out with no significant impact on your general health. So don't think, well, it might be fine, I can just leave it for a bit. Go and seek medical attention. We're much rather see people and say, no, I'm happy with that, than see people when it's been left for a long time and actually it's got to a point where actually it's much more difficult to treat. So absolutely, if you notice anything new on the skin, then you should be seeking medical attention.
Consultant dermatologist Emma Wedgeworth. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Now, most of us are aware that as we get older, our eyesight deteriorates. It may start simply with needing reading glasses. That will come to all of us. But there are more serious conditions, and the one I want to talk about today may affect 1 in 10 people over the age of 65. It's called age-related macular degeneration and can lead to visual distortion and blind spots in the centre of your vision. I've been talking to Dr. Alexander Ioannidis, consultant ophthalmologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, and I asked him, first of all, what we can expect to happen to our eyes as we get older.
OK, well, I'll pick the age of 40 to start off what happens to eyes as we get older, because when people get to the age of 40, the College of Ophthalmologists and the College of Optometrists recommend seeing your local optician once every 2 years, mainly to look out for glaucoma and other eye diseases such as macular degeneration or early cataract. When we hit our mid-40s, everybody's lens starts to stop focusing vernier. So if you've got good unaided distance vision, you start to find that your arms aren't long enough, the light isn't bright enough, and you have to go along to the local supermarket or optician to get some plus one reading glasses. If you're short-sighted, you find that you're much happier reading without your glasses. And if you're long-sighted, you can sometimes find that you start to need not just reading glasses, but glasses for distance and then bifocals or varifocals. And that's because we become presbyopic, which literally is Greek for old man's eye. And that's what it's called.
And it happens to everyone?
Everybody, yeah. If we're lucky to live long enough, that's what will happen to our lens as a natural phenomenon. But there are other diseases to look out for as we get older, and the big three are macular degeneration, which is the commonest cause of blindness in this country, cataract, which is the commonest operation in the NHS of any specialty, and glaucoma, which is becoming increasingly common. And in all of those three conditions, major advances have been made in the last few years.
Well, let's talk about macular degeneration. Now, I think we have to explain what it means first.
Okay, well, macular degeneration is the commonest cause of people being registered as blind in the UK. Macular degeneration is a retinal disease. So the retina lines the inside of the eye like wallpaper or like the film of an old-fashioned camera. And it is the film equivalent in an old-fashioned camera. Now, the macula is that part of the film that is in the centre of the photograph. So it's a part of the retina that you use to look directly at people's faces, to look at the clock on the wall or the writing on the page. And as we get older, there are various products of the metabolism of the normal functioning of the retina that cause a build-up of debris and waste products right in that central part of the retina. And these can disturb the natural architecture of the retina and cause small blood vessels to grow through the retina. And when these new blood vessels grow, they're not as robust and sturdy as our normal blood vessels, and they can break down and bleed and lead to a very sudden and catastrophic loss of all that central vision.
Tell me more about that. So sudden and catastrophic sounds bad.
It is bad because you lose the vision in that eye, and you'll always keep your peripheral vision, but you won't be able to look directly at anything. So if you still have peripheral vision, you can navigate your way around a familiar surrounding, such as your own house or your own bedroom. But the moment you're out in the street or in a strange building, you are unable to confidently move around at all. But apart from that, your central vision has been lost, so you can't read, you can't do shopping, you can't look at change in the money, you can't look at prices, you can't look at read products. You have your other eye, but if you've lost your vision with macular degeneration in one eye, you're at higher risk of losing it in the other eye. But there are new treatments which can not salvage lost vision so much, but certainly help to prevent losing vision. So when these blood vessels are developing, people who have macular degeneration can start to develop symptoms of distortion, such that if you were to look at straight lines like a door frame or a window frame, you'd find that instead of it being straight and vertical, there'd be corrugations like corrugated iron. It would be wavy or curvy or distorted. And writing on the page can become not straight lines, but can become more distorted and curvy. And this is a very important sign because that is the effect of the blood vessels going under the retina, almost like a snake under a carpet, ruffling up the carpet. And that's a sign that the blood vessels are growing, and with new treatments, they are injections in the eye, they can halt and reverse those blood vessels and allow you to keep your central vision.
I can imagine that being pretty haunting, actually, and not a very nice feeling.
No, and it's a symptom, because it is haunting and worrying, and it's not healed by putting drops in or rubbing the eye or trying to get some sense of it. It's enough of a worry to make people want to seek help and talk about it.
So what you're trying to do is spot the macular degeneration before the blood vessels burst.
Yes. And again, regular checks with the optician will look for any signs of the debris of these metabolic products that can lead to macular degeneration, and that'll get you hooked into the local eye service where they might well follow you up, talk to you more about it, give you more information about it, so that you'll have easier access and know exactly where to go should you start to find this distortion later on.
How quickly do I need to do something about it? What do I need to be noticing to get something done?
Distortion of your central vision. That's the big red flag to go straight away to either the GP or the local eye casualty or eye unit to get it checked out.
Are there any particular activities or lifestyles or anything that would make me more at risk?
Smoking. Smoking with macular degeneration and also smoking with cataract as well. Both of the smoking is a risk factor for both of those. Sometimes with early macular degeneration nowadays, we can recommend multivitamin dosages, and there are eye ocular concoctions of the vitamins and zinc and xanthine, and these have been shown to help, but how much in a well-nourished European population they really do help is difficult to know.
Does it hurt?
No, it's a painless loss of vision.
What is the treatment?
The treatment is an injection of chemicals that block the formation of new blood vessels and promote their regression. And some of these treatments can be every month for the first 3 months, look for regression, and then further injections. And some of the newer treatments will require injections to be less often. And these are, because they're a new treatment, they're being evaluated and altered and improved all the time. So it's an exciting field for eye surgeons and ophthalmologists at the moment, because for the first time ever, we're really able to do something for macular degeneration, when even 10, 15 years ago, it was a matter of registering people as blind and getting hold of a dog for them.
The idea of injections, are the injections in the eye? This isn't something that sounds very appealing.
Sounds gruesome and painful and a form of torture, but the eye responds incredibly well to a simple anaesthetic, which are numbing eye drops, and it completely numbs the eye, so it can be completely painless.
Is there anything I can do to help myself, either to treat or to prevent?
Stop smoking and a healthy diet with vegetables, and a lot of the orangey-style vegetables, like the yellow sweet peppers, or what the Americans call squash, and all those kind of foods with the yellowy dyes can be helpful, yes. But a good healthy diet rich in fruit and vegetables.
Dr. Alexander Ioannidis. You can find much more information on macular degeneration on the NHS Choices website. And in our next programme, he'll be talking about cataracts and the treatments available for this very common problem. You're listening to Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Now, anyone not had a filling? Not many of us can say that about our teeth, and we spoke in a recent programme about the number of children having some or even all of their teeth taken out because of decay. Today we're focusing on keeping our teeth healthy in older age, and I've been speaking to Alva MacDonald from the Eastman Dental Institute in London. I asked her first whether, in general, we're keeping our own teeth longer than we used to.
People are retaining their teeth for longer. There are 6% of the adult population which have no teeth, and this compares with 28% in 1978. So people are now retaining some teeth, and over half of 85-year-olds and older retain some natural teeth. So they have their teeth in their mouths for longer, and therefore they're at risk of developing decay and gum disease for that much longer.
Why are we keeping our teeth longer?
We're keeping our teeth longer because we know more about the diseases that affect teeth. We have a better understanding of cleaning our teeth and also of diet and the impact of diet on teeth. Alongside that, most people are using toothpaste, which contains fluoride, which again helps to reduce decay in teeth. So for all of those factors, we are retaining them for longer and therefore need to maintain them for longer.
So you mentioned diet. I mean, I know with children, sugar is the big villain of the piece. What about for adults?
We know for adults that there is an increase in snacking. People are eating on the go, and people are not eating 3 square meals per day. Unfortunately, with snacking, tends to be fizzy drinks, you know, dried fruit, biscuits, things that are easy to eat on the go. And of course, these all contain sugars, many of which contain hidden sugars. People think they're eating a healthy diet, but they've actually got more sugar intake than they realise. The frequency of sugar is also important. And that's something that I find is frequently missing for people's understanding of decay. Because if you eat all of your sugar at one time during the day, that will only slightly increase your risk of decay. Whereas if you eat sugar regularly throughout the day, such as sugar in tea and coffees, the occasional biscuit, the occasional mint that people suck, all of these add up to frequencies of sugars, which will increase your decay rate a lot.
So that's interesting. So one slice of cake once a day is better than the odd drink here and there and the odd snack.
Absolutely.
What does sugar do?
The important thing about decay is that you have to have sugar and you have to have plaque. Plaque is the sort of debris that's on your teeth, that builds up on your teeth, and it contains bugs, basically microorganisms, and they will break down sugar. So if you eat sugar, the plaque on your teeth will break down that sugar, and you will end up with a very acid environment in your mouth. And it varies in the length of time it takes to get back to a normal neutral balance, but it's guessed at approximated at about 20 minutes. So every time you have one small bit of sugar, it will attack your teeth for another 20 minutes afterwards. Over a period of time, you get continual acid attacks on your teeth. And if these are prolonged, you will then develop a cavity. So to begin with, you have enamel on the outside of your teeth that can start to decay. At that point, you can reverse it. You can reverse the decay by brushing your teeth really well, stopping eating sugars. But once it gets as far as the inside of your tooth and you develop a cavity, that needs to be restored.
So what should we be doing?
What we should be doing is we should be cleaning our teeth twice a day. And we know from the survey that 75% of us do clean our teeth twice a day. However, 2/3 of the people in the survey had plaque on their teeth. So people are cleaning their teeth using the same method each time, which may not be the most effective. So they're putting in all the effort, but not really getting the outcome that they would like. So I would say speaking to your dentist or to the dental hygienist in a practice, if there's one there, to make sure that you're effectively cleaning your teeth is important. And then with regard to diet, making sure that you're looking at the frequency of sugar intake and also being aware of the foods that have sugar in them. Because with hidden sugars, people think they're eating a healthy diet, but they're not.
And I think the thing is, as you get older, you're more likely to eat kind of processed food with hidden sugars.
Yes. There are particular risks associated, for example, with these sort of over 75-year-olds, because many of these will eat a processed food diet. They won't tend to eat 3 square meals because their appetite is reduced. They maybe live alone and therefore don't have the motivation to cook a big meal. And so they snack more, eat processed foods more. They may have reduced numbers of teeth, which may mean that they prefer to eat less chewy foods anyway. And so they can develop decay. That age group also frequently will have a reduced salivary flow, and you get reduced saliva flow due to multiple medications and chronic chronic illnesses.
Which and saliva is a good thing to have flowing.
Saliva is a very good thing to have flowing because salivary flow cleans the teeth, washes away the debris, food debris from the teeth. It also helps restore the mouth to a neutral environment from acid environment. So it has a buffering capacity to do that. And it also has a remineralization capacity so that if you've got that early decay period, it can reverse that by remineralizing your enamel.
So that's that. It seems to me there are a couple of other problems that, that elderly people might face. I mean, for a start, they may have arthritis in their hands or joints. It's actually difficult to brush your teeth when you get older.
That's absolutely right. And that's the other factor. The cleaning ability may be reduced. Eyesight may be reduced. As you say, manual dexterity due to arthritis, maybe a stroke. You know, many people are just not as dexterous as they get older.
What's the way around that then?
Well, electric toothbrushes work very well for a lot of people who have difficulty brushing their teeth. And they help because they are effective cleaners, but they also frequently have a time buzzer on them, which indicates how long you should be brushing for.
Seems to wait forever before it buzzes.
It does, but that just means you're probably doing too quick a job with your manual if you feel that with the electric. So yes, talking to your dentist and just getting a little bit of instruction on how to use them is a useful thing to do for people who are having challenges with their manual dexterity.
The other thing it seems to me is that when I go to the dentist, not often enough, it's actually expensive. And that must put a lot of people off looking after their teeth.
Yes, absolutely. And I understand that this is a big issue for a lot of people. What I would recommend is that if people maintain their teeth very well, then when they do get to the dentist, they're going to need to have less done. So if they can actually keep their teeth effectively clean and look at the sugars in their diet, then they should reduce the need for treatment. And that's a very economical way of reducing their needs for dentistry input. So home maintenance is key to ensuring that you can keep the cost of dentistry down.
And is it the case, I think, that these days the decay is not necessarily only on the visible part of the tooth, as decay of the root as well as you get older?
Yes.
Is that true? And why does that happen?
That's absolutely right. Roots can decay, particularly when they become exposed. And in the older age groups, for example, over 75s, where they're more likely to have root exposure if their gums have receded and roots are then exposed, they can develop decay. And in fact, in this adult dental health survey, 20% of the 75 to 84 year olds had root decay.
And that's the end of the tooth?
Not necessarily. It can be restored, but it needs to be picked up early enough. It could mean the end of the tooth if it's let go for too long. So attending your dentist at a minimum of every 2 years, but allowing the dentist to decide what the frequency of recall should be for you depending on your dental needs is important.
Alva MacDonald from the Eastman Dental Institute in London. Finally today, a story I'm not sure any of us think too much about. We get great care from the NHS, we expect it, and it's free. But what if you're homeless or a refugee? Healthcare isn't so easy to come across. No fixed abode. It's tricky. And unsurprisingly, people with no roots, no home, often have the greatest needs. Rosie Runciman went to Leeds to talk to John Walsh, who runs a medical centre aimed at helping those who have nothing. But first, Fatima from Nigeria, who fled here after being raped by her uncle and having at least 8 abortions.
I can say in African way, we call it dead walking. Like, someone is dead. I wish you know me. I was dead. I'm not myself. That's why I can't leave your street practice, because they really help me. They give me back my head. They treat me like somebody, not like a salon seeker.
Fatima is just one person who's benefited from the York Street health practice in Leeds. John Walsh is the practice manager there.
We moved to this building 20 years ago. Before that, there'd been a long history, including some GP cover for people who were homeless. And there was a growing recognition that people are marginalised, people are very vulnerable, often don't fit into normal systems. So therefore, there is a need and a value in creating specialist services that work with people in holistic ways.
And so what sort of people come here typically?
Probably 40% of our client population are from the asylum system. The other 60% or so are people who are Indigenous homeless people. So the main issues we would see from many of the Indigenous homeless people would be mental health, drugs, alcohol. Often, though, the issues which we see go back to childhood. So therefore, the concepts of trust and relationships are really key to what we do. We try to create here for people a centre of welcome and well-being. We make a commitment to create an okay space so that people feel part of the work here. So, for example, we say that receptionists have to smile, have to welcome people, that everybody in the building has to have that welcoming approach to those people who walk through the doors. What vulnerable people, the most vulnerable people in our society, should receive is what we would want for our own loved ones.
How popular is it with vulnerable people in Leeds?
Presently, we have over 1,200 people registered with us. And we also know there's people out there who should be with us, who aren't at the moment. So we do both work in the clinic here, and we also go out onto the streets and work in asylum and homeless centres in order to reach out to people. The service is an incredibly popular service, and one of our great challenges is when people are resettled in accommodation, helping them to move on. Often people will not want to move on because of the relationships, the rapport, the bonds they have built here. And often this is a space where people can start to really address some of the issues they've carried with them for a long time. So, for example, it's not unusual for clients to say things like, "This is the first doctor I've told what happened to me 40 years ago, where I was sexually abused as a child." So this becomes a place, insofar as we can make it one, of trust and openness. And it can be very difficult when people start to grow and move forward and make improvements, then to move on. Our aim is to help people resettle in the mainstream community. We know that some people aren't ready for that, so we are allowed to keep some people on and keep trying to work with them to help them as much as possible resettle in mainstream services.
And what do you think is so successful about your formula?
I think York Street at its best is able to work with people's inner needs and work for inner change. I think because we've been around a long time, we can help people get accommodation, support, benefits, clothing, food, support. And what we often see is one of two things. Either we often see that people within a year or so come back homeless again, or people stay housed but remain distressed, unhappy and unhealthy, really. What gives us a lot of hope and scope, really, is where we see people make inner changes, where they change their vision of themselves and their place in the world. And I think the most positive work that goes on in these walls at York Street Health Practice is where we can help people find hope, where we can help people find their own gifts and help people find themselves. And I think that York Street is a place, when it works at its best, where people can have many chances at trying to help put their lives back together.
Well, you personally are out about it and about in the community a lot, aren't you? Firsthand, so you are on the streets, in hostels. What have you noticed over the last 5 years in terms of changes in health conditions? Have you noticed particular changes?
I think the health conditions of homeless people are still the same. Homeless people still die at a young age. The figures from Homeless Link from a few years ago in London was 47 as the mortality rate. If any of us lived in this area where we are sat now in Leeds, we'd probably live to about 80, 81. Homeless people would die somewhere in their late 40s. And York Street exists really as a place to challenge that. It exists as something to force, hopefully, to dissolve some of those health inequalities. So in some ways, I think the health conditions are still there and still continue. I think what I have seen, which is very positive in the city of Leeds, is that there's much more joined up working, there's much more integration, inclusion is very high on the agenda. And I think Leeds has a great commitment that inclusion should be the work of a city. That inclusion is all about cities working together and that everyone can have a part in that well-being, everyone can have a part in that inclusion. So whether you're a lorry driver or a Lord Mayor, doesn't matter, everyone can play some sort of part in making a difference for the most vulnerable people in our society.
And what outcome has given you the most satisfaction over the last year?
We've seen some, and I've personally seen some amazing recovery stories. I don't think I'd be exaggerating to use the words transformation or healing or recovery to describe those journeys. I've certainly seen people who have started off with the very worst of backgrounds, through many years of work, both external things such as housing and benefits, but also internal work, their own reflection, their own inner work, move forward to stable, happy existences. And I've seen some incredible journeys and some incredible stories happen, which gives me great hope in the potential that all human beings have, and also the amazing gifts which homeless people have. And often we don't see those gifts because problems get in the way. But I think one of the challenges for any of us working in any sort of health service is to see people not as problems, but to see through the problem to the person.
And can you think of any sort of particular examples?
One case that comes to mind is, which was one of the most incredible cases I met, was a man who had been very severely abused when he was young and awfully sexually, physically abused. I remember one day meeting him and he told me that he'd made the decision, and the decision was to forgive the people who'd abused him. And he said to me, and it's a decision which he made, and to this day, 10 years later, he still rings us up, we meet up for a cup of tea sometimes to talk. He's still living in that freedom. And he said to me, he said, I've been a victim for 42 years, but I've got to a place now through my own work, through my own journey, where I need to let go of my being a victim and to be free. And it's an amazing, really, that I think that that man got to that state where he could let go of this awful pain. And I know people are at different stages of the journey, and I think for somebody to move from all the anger, all that pain, all the awful trauma to a position where that person is now living a life which is quite free and full, to me points to an incredible amount of transformation in that person's life, really.
John Walsh, practice manager at the York Street Health Practice in Leeds. Finally, time for our thank you, a chance for someone to show their gratitude to a person who's helped them with some aspect of their health. Today, Rosie Runciman asked Imogen, who's coping with an aggressive type of skin cancer called melanoma, if there's anyone she'd like to thank.
The team at Oxford are amazing. They have restored my faith in the NHS and in the care and support that medical professions can provide.
Okay, that's it for this week. Next time, are we taking A&E for granted? Are too many of us turning up at accident and emergency departments when we really shouldn't be there? Also, we'll be talking about cataracts and the science of anaesthesia. That's next time. For now, this is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Thank you for listening. Stay well.
The opinions expressed in this programme are the individual's own personal opinion and do not reflect the views or official policy of the Department of Health or NHS Choices. This programme was clinically reviewed in August 2015.